a ton. Welcome to Brizzy.
Thanks, Alex. No worries, really enjoying it. Great views, great food, awesome steaks. It's awesome.
Yeah, man. We just went to the beach. And when we got to the beach, the sun disappeared.
That's been my experience in Australia, man. From Perth to Melbourne to Sydney, the weather has not been cooperating until Brisbane finally. But then my one day at the beach at in Brisbane starts to rain a little bit.
It's all right. We actually did get a little bit of sun, so it was all right. And then we had some good lunch. But anyway, in the spirit of time, because we've got a poker game straight after this. So let's we'll kick into all of this stuff. I had a whole agenda. I don't know if we're going to be able to get through all of it.
We'll do our best.
So I thought we'd start with, look, let's just, instead of background and history, I think people, if they want to know more about your background, they can look it up. If they want to know more about my background, they can look it up and do all that sort of stuff. So let's jump past that. Let's go into, I've got a question here about Bitcoin, and let's just make it an open discussion. You know, people think it's a currency. Some people think it's technology. Some people say it's an asset. Some people say it's something else. Tell me what you think. I'll tell you what I think. Let's see where
sure.
this thing goes.
I don't like using the word currency. The word currency has a very specific definition and mm-hmm. it involves a government entity.
Yep.
So I hate using the word currency. The word that I like to use is a medium of exchange.
Yep.
But I put something in front of it. I put censorship resistant medium of exchange.
Yep.
And to me, Bitcoin really changed the game. It gave us an unconfiscatable asset for the first time in human history. We're probably going to talk about human history later, so I'll
yes.
save that.
Cool.
But it gave us, in addition to that, a means to transfer value without anyone in the middle over great distances. And mm-hmm. I think this is going to be a game changer. And I don't see it as, I see it as the ultimate fintech. It's the combination of finance and technology. But the way I like to describe it, it's simply, it's money and value transfer utilizing 21st century technology.
Cool, all right. I mean, I'll chime in on that one and just say, when I look at Bitcoin, the best answer I can give is when people ask me why the hell I got involved in this space, they're like, all right, you've been in tech before, you're an engineer, you did all this sort of stuff, and what the hell are you doing in crypto? And for me, I love this space a lot, purely because it's this combination of all of these disparate industries or these disparate disciplines that people traditionally wouldn't have been collaborating with. You know, you've got the game theorists, you've got, you know, there's sociology and psychology in there, there's markets, there's economics, there's computer science, there's cryptography, there's privacy, there's all of these concepts all rolled into one. And I think there's also this element of, I guess, I don't want to say fuck you to the establishment, but it's got that vibe because that's sort of the grassroots that it's grown up in, right? And if it wasn't for all of those things, I remember, you know, our best friend Craig Wright was, you know, made a comment about Silk Road being the worst thing that could have ever happened to Bitcoin, and like, I couldn't disagree more with you.
Yeah, I agree with you. I couldn't disagree more with him as well. But the more important part is, it's not up to us to decide whether Silk Road was good or bad for Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. It's there. Like, mm-hmm. I hate it when people, you know, say something is or isn't good. Some things are just the way they are.
Yep.
You can't change that. Silk Road is a part of Bitcoin's history.
Yep.
It's what got us here. You can't say that we would have been better off without Silk Road, and you can't say that we would have been worse off without Silk Road. The answer is we don't know.
True. It's one of the things we're going to never know. But what's interesting is if we look back on any more transformative technology, a lot of people don't realize this, but the first major adopters of motor vehicles were actually bank robbers. People don't realize that.
Actually, I didn't know. This has been, so I've been using this example in forever where I've said, you know, I bet you the first buyers of cars were bank robbers because they can get away from cops faster on horses.
Exactly. And
I had absolutely no evidence to back up that claim, but I've always used to say it. So yep. If you actually know that for a fact, that's great for me to hear.
It's true. From what I've read, from what I understand, it is. And the thing is, we forget about it every single time, right? It's a generational thing. Like if we go back 30 years, right before you and I were sort of, you know, I guess, you would have been 9 years old, I would have been one. But I it was, the internet was coming up, and that was viewed as the place that no normal person would ever interact with. It was like purely for porno and hackers and all sorts of illegal illicit shit. It's the same thing over and over again. And this is, you know, the early adopters are generally the fringes when it comes to these things. And when you have a grassroots movement from the fringes in, you end up getting larger adoption. But
No, it's I think going 30 years is a little too far, more like, you know, 22 to 25 years. Because I remember when I was still in high school, I don't know, I was like 14, 15 or something, and AOL, Instant Messenger, is becoming very, very popular at that time. And it was so funny. Everyone was like, well, you can't talk to strangers on the internet. I mean, the next thing you know, you might, they might pick,
knock
come,
on your
come
door.
Over and you're going to just get into their cars. And that's like the most popular app right now, like, on the internet, you know, strangers picking you up in their cars.
It's so true, man. That touches on an interesting point, this concept of trust. So I want to dig into that. So whenever I give a talk and I talk to people about, you know, what Bitcoin is, why it has value, and, you know, I end up in a lot of arguments with Bcashers who think that the value comes from the speed of transaction or the size of blocks or whatever other ridiculous idea they've got. And what I try and bring it back to is this concept of shared fictions. We listen to that, what's it called? The TED Talk, Yuval on the way. This is a book that everyone should read. It's on Tone's reading list officially.
It is on my reading list. Listen to the TED Talk by Yuval, and tell us about it.
The basic premise is, it talks about the difference between our species as humans, or as Homo sapiens, as a subset of humans, and what distinguishes us from every other species on the face of the planet. And what it is our ability to cooperate in a way that's both flexible and in large numbers. So in the animal kingdom, you've got species that can operate in large numbers, but not very flexibly. Ants, bees, and all that sort of stuff. And then you've got species that can operate very flexibly, but not in large numbers. And the predicate behind that is, in one instance, you've got large numbers built on biological predicates, and here you've got small numbers that are flexible, built on biological predicates that are governed by trust. It's, you know, if you and I were both chimpanzees, we would only work together is if I, you know, touched you, trusted you, you know, slapped you across the ear or whatever. Human beings are the only species that can cooperate with each other and not have to biologically or intimately trust each other. And we've built entire social strata on top of that. And we've got complex societies because of that reason. And what I always tell people is, the oldest shared fiction, and the one that's been there since the beginning of time, is this trading of value, or this trading of promises. Now, we originally, people think that trade started with barter, and it actually didn't. Trade started with the trading of promises. And we used to keep track of those promises, and that was the first ledger. Those ledgers have evolved, and we've had units at each stage of history that represent, that make it easier for us to track the ledger, whether it was shells and that, you know, ray stones, and it's sort of evolved into metals, into gold, into gold-backed paper, and it's become more efficient over time. So the key thing to know about money is that money is not an object. Money was not shells, money is not gold, money is not the paper in our pockets, money is not the digits in the bank, money is also not Bitcoin, money is just a social contract. It's a social consensus, it's something that we all agree with. But for the first time in history, we've got a form of that that is a self-sovereign bearer asset. It's, you know, it's censorship resistant, it's got all of these units, all of these attributes that will make it a fantastic form of money, value transfer, and exchange over a period of time. But the predicate is trust, which means Bitcoin's only been out for 10 years. You know, all of these people that say, oh, it's not a medium of account now, look at it, it's dropped from $6,000 to $3,000 in a week. A store of value or a medium of exchange. Of course it's not, because it's 10 years old. This shit's gonna take decades for people to trust it properly, for capital to flow in, for it to form the new backbone of our infrastructure. So coming back to it is, this is a game about trust, and we've got a new thing that we can collectively imbue value on, and we can, we're right at, when I tell people, you think you missed out because you weren't in Bitcoin in 2014, you ain't missed nothing yet. Like, we are still early on. So that's sort of my thoughts and why I think this book comes in handy, is when people transcend the argument about features and, you know, block size and speed and all that sort of shit, they realize that Bitcoin's innovation was not the blockchain. Bitcoin's innovation was all of these disparate technologies coming together, and then the early adopters coming and building up this network that we've slowly by slowly begun to trust and imbue value on. And it, because it's a recursive type of network, the more people that believe in it and value it, the more valuable it actually becomes. And it's crossed that threshold. It's the only one that's crossed that threshold out of everything. So anyway, that's my two cents. I don't know if you got any comments on that.
Yeah, no, plenty. And you're right. You were alluding to it, but that applies to all currencies. That
it does,
applies to all means of exchange. The only thing that matters to a currency is confidence and trust in that currency.
Yep.
The US dollar will continue to be the world reserve currency as long as the world trusts the US dollar more than any other currency.
Yep.
It's irrelevant how much money Bernanke printed, how much money Yellen printed after him.
Yep.
And they don't even print the money that Treasury does, but it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter how much money the US government prints. Doesn't matter who the chair of the Federal Reserve is.
Yep.
It does have to do with who the president is, actually. And but outside of that, your money is only as good as the confidence not only your people have in that money, but the world does.
Yep.
And no one has confidence in the Venezuelan currency, and that's why it's going through hyperinflation. People lost confidence in the Zimbabwe currency when the new government came in, decided to take away people's land, and people just lost confidence in the currency.
100%.
Hyperinflations are not too much printing of money. Hyperinflations are loss of confidence in that currency. And
so
it'll take Bitcoin a while for people to gain the trust that Bitcoin is potential, the next global means of value transfer.
Correct, 100%. And I just really want to reiterate that for the people listening to this, because when I heard you say it the other night at the meetup, I was like, holy shit, breath of fresh air. Everyone runs around and says hyperinflation happens due to money printing. It does not. It happens due to a collapse in confidence. Now, oftentimes, that coincides with money printing.
Because the government still has to pay the bills. The government has the biggest bills they have to pay. And if the people start to lose money in their currency, then the government can't pay their bills, but they have the keys to the printing press.
Correct, exactly.
So they start printing the money to pay their bills, making it worse for their population.
Correct, and that's what then breaks the confidence, and you get that cascade.
Exactly. A terrible spiral down.
And this is what's so powerful about Bitcoin that a lot of people don't realize, is that because that limit is hard-coded in there, there is no keys, exactly. No, but the keys got thrown away.
Right. Well, everyone is trying, right?
Yep.
All of these altcoins, all of these Bitcoin hard forks, everyone wants those keys. Everyone wants the keys to the printing press.
Yep.
Everyone wants to control the Bitcoin code. Everyone wants to control Bitcoin mining.
Yep.
So every time you see a better Bitcoin, it's a guy that wants to control the printing of their own money.
Yep. Yep. And as we've seen throughout history, like, it's very difficult, it's not the most intelligent idea to place your trust in one guy or on one team or in, you know, one group of people. I mean, the shit doesn't work, and it's not because people are inherently evil or that there's some, you know, lizard people running the world in the background. That's not the case. It's just that it's too fucking complex and we mess it up. It's it. It's just, let's be pragmatic about it. We don't have to be conspiracy theorists about it. So, you know, there's obviously always some form of conspiracy going on everywhere. Like, I don't care what anybody says, but, you know, things are complex, and trying to manage something as important to the social strata as money or as value transfer, and trying to manage it the way we've managed it up until now, is generally ends with, you know, a loss of confidence. So I think this is one of the only things we've seen. And that's why, you know, in this whole crypto space, and, you know, we all go through our little bit of, you know, altcoin fever, and then, you know, a lot of us who have been around for a while, we end up circling, you know, back to Bitcoin. And the reason that's important to remember is, if we want to have any shot at making this thing successful, we should all put our resources behind the one horse that has the best chance to win.
Yeah, that's how I always saw it.
That's
going back to the loss of confidence, Bitcoin might be going through a minor loss of confidence right now, because the price has dropped severely in the last couple of weeks, And now people are starting to get nervous about the mining infrastructure because they're afraid that Bitcoin is too cheap and the miners are paying too much money. So now the miners are going to turn off their miners, and that would lead to lower hash rate. So now people are getting nervous about the system and starting to lose confidence. That causes them to sell the Bitcoin, being afraid that the miners are going to turn off the power and stop mining. That causes the bigger price and the drop of Bitcoin.
Correct.
That raises the probability of the miners.
It's all psychological. It's all psychological.
Absolutely.
It's all the story. And what happens is when the story starts to unravel, it cascades.
Right. And then when Bitcoin falls low enough, and then you see that it doesn't die, and then it starts to go back up, confidence will come back.
Correct. It's the this is no different than any other market. If we picked up a book from the 1900s, it'd say the exact same thing over and over again, because all that markets are, and this I think we should probably touch on this, is, you know, markets and charts, people think it's some form of either magic or math or anything like that. All it is just a representation of the madness of crowds.
Right.
That's all it is. It's a representation of emotion. It's a representation of consensus of people with no consensus. And it sort of converges into, you know, units in time, points in time.
And here's another one for you to ponder about. Like, the interesting thing is, you would think that in the last 100 years, with the advancement in technology, humans would be able to have a better ability to see through bullshit and be more conscious of what's real and what's fake and what's propaganda and what isn't. And I don't think it's gotten any better.
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. Because I think technology is a magnifier. That's the thing. So I would say technology and money are magnifiers in people's lives. So back in the day, we had misinformation, and that was the snake oil salesman, you know, hundreds of years ago. Now we've got, you know, whatever, fake news or dumbass bloggers or moronic YouTubers or BitConnect people or USI Tech people, whatever. And what you end up getting is a situation where the stupidity is magnified. There's just more noise. I would say the percentage of morons to, you know, intelligent people has never actually changed. I just think that everything just happens on a larger scale now. Which, you know, because I had this discussion with a friend of mine the other a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about, oh, you know, how less connected we are in today's world. And I would say, you know, there's this famous photo of, you know, it's not a meme, but it's a juxtaposition of two photos of people on the train today and all looking at their smartphones, and people on the train in the 1920s, I think it was 1923, and they've all got the newspapers. Yeah, exactly.
So nothing's changed.
Exactly. We're still the same as human beings. We haven't really evolved that much, because biologically it takes us a long time to evolve.
But some things are interesting, right? Like, when I look back at the time, I'm like, man, how the hell did I used to meet my friends at some random place at a specific time without cell phones?
Yeah.
And we all met and we all found the place. Like today,
everyone would be lost.
You wouldn't be able to find your corner store without your cell phone. And the other thing that's actually kind of funny, I remember, again, I was already, I mean, cell phones were kind of around in the earliest, but even like when I was starting out college, it's like, hey, you're gonna have a bunch of friends over for a little barbecue for dinner. Like, I knew like a week in advance exactly how many people were coming. And today, it's like, when's the barbecue? Oh, it's today at 4 o'clock. How many people are coming?
I don't know.
Somewhere between 3 and 23.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no idea. Because no one has been able to give me a definite answer yet.
Yep.
Like, but back then, like, you knew, you committed to shit. Like, weeks in advance. You didn't have all this information at your fingertips. Everything is, and I'm guilty of it as well. Everything is a maybe, because someone can text you up to the minute before and give you something better to do.
Yep.
And that didn't happen 20 years ago.
I agree with you. Funny you say that, because I used to knock on doors when I was like 18, 19. It was like my first thing to try and get out of debt after I lost money on the stock market. And when we used to go to places, we had no GPSs back then. We had the maps, and we'd be driving around looking for what fucking street we're on, just in whichever weird country town we were in. But we found our way. It was interesting. So the thing is, we're adaptive. That's the thing. So we've just adapted to something new now, which is a lot more uncertain. And, you know, we make do with this. It's interesting. All right, we've gone through Bitcoin as a currency, as an asset, as something else. I want to touch on one last thing there. So The concept of it being an asset. So I usually use this when I talk to people about, you know, why they should hold Bitcoin. You know, I talk about it. I talk less about, you know, the you know, this reserve settlement layer that the world might one day use as a financial you know, settlement layer and all this sort of stuff. I talk more about, for now, the game is about accumulation. It's something that everyone should hold a little bit of, and they should view it much like gold is viewed as an asset that is, you know, I mean, gold is as censorship resistant in Bitcoin, I would say, in the sense that if you have it and you own it, mm-hmm. You can hide your gold in, you know,
but
in the
still
dirt.
Still confiscatable.
Sort of, because if someone confiscates your private key, it's the same thing as confiscating your gold.
No, not exactly, because if they confiscate your, well, your private key should be encrypted so they can't spend it, right? But once they confiscate your gold, and gold wasn't always confiscatable. I think gold became confiscatable once metal detectors were invented.
Okay, that's fair.
So with the creation of metal detectors, it's now almost impossible for you to hide that gold.
I need my tinfoil hat now. The government's gonna come take my gold, man. Look, that's fair. But I think, so I would agree then that Bitcoin is a little bit more confiscatable, but it's the same thing. It's you're either finding the actual piece of gold or you're finding the instrument that represents right. your Bitcoin, which is the private key. So,
but they still can't spend it. And if you memorize your private key, you can then take it back from them.
It'll be a Manchurian candidate. They'll put you in there. They'll figure out what it is. So do you agree with that concept of viewing it as an asset that people should
absolutely.
Hold?
Oh, yeah. absolutely. And it's an amazing asset. It's a brand new asset
yep.
that is almost uncorrelated to your other assets. So yep. it's almost a must to have a little bit of Bitcoin yep. in your portfolio. Now, it'll be unfortunate if you bought it at the peak of one of the three bubbles that we've
yep.
had.
Yep.
And you know, if you bought it at the peak, you know, hopefully you bought a little bit, not too much. But yeah, now at these lower prices, you should start to consider it as even for diversification purposes
100%
into your portfolio.
100%. Actually, you touched on an interesting piece there about correlation, right? So I remember I got asked to write an article for the media here in Australia about a month ago, and one of the things was, why is it important to have a diversified crypto portfolio? That was what they wanted me to answer. And I sent back, I said, the concept of a diversified portfolio in crypto is non-existent, because the concept of diversification is predicated on correlation. And in the crypto market, everything is correlated.
They're completely correlated.
To basically to a level of 0.9 or 0.95 yeah. or even almost one. So if you build a portfolio of crypto, on the way down, it's just gonna accelerate on
right.
the way down, and it could potentially
right.
accelerate on
right.
the way
up. You're actually just increasing your beta.
It's exactly. All you're doing is leveraging.
Right. Yeah. All you're doing is increasing your yeah. beta, and it's almost like diversifying Google stock with Google's competitors for browsing.
It's even worse than that. Yeah, exactly. It drives me nuts, because see, diversification is supposed to lower the risk and the volatility
right.
in your portfolio, whereas it does the opposite.
Right.
It's so dumb. It's like,
yeah.
So anyway, so when I tell people like what to, you know, when they're like, oh, what should I buy in crypto? I generally still recommend to, because I think there is a global use case for a censorship resistant type of money or store of value or value exchange or whatever we're going to fucking call it. I still think, you know, in the absence of greater privacy in Bitcoin, I think Monero represents something really interesting as well. So I generally tell people, you know, 80% Bitcoin, 20% Monero if you want to increase your leverage position. But other than that, primarily Bitcoin. And, you know, when we built Amber, we were originally going to list Bitcoin and Ethereum to begin with. And the longer we've sort of hung around the market, the longer we've been in there, I've realized, look, we want to help people be better stewards of their money and have some form of protection. So if they're going to take their spare change and put it somewhere, they can either put it in like this managed fund with Acorns or Rays or someone like that, or they can put it in this new asset class that is nascent, that is worth, I mean, $100 billion, maybe $50 billion by the end of this week. but it's really tiny when you compare it to everything else. So if you're going to put money that you're not going to notice somewhere, you may as well put it into something that's got the potential for 10x, 100x, 1000x return. And that's literally why we built Amber, is to allow more people to do that. Because, yeah, look, my whole view on this thing, for the next 5 to 10 years, this is not something that you buy for the purpose of spending. It's not a currency. It's something that you buy for the purpose of holding, accumulating, so that you can participate in this new economic infrastructure that we're building. So I don't know if you got any comments off the back of
that.
Yeah, no,
I mean, I'm pretty much in agreement. I personally wouldn't diversify Bitcoin into Monero, but we're not gonna get into that discussion.
Yep.
But I do think Bitcoin will serve all, I mean, I just think Bitcoin will eventually do everything better than any of its other alternatives. And yeah, Bitcoin is not a great currency right now. It's still pretty volatile.
Yep. Yep.
It's not as user friendly as people like to claim that it is.
Yep.
And man, like, and it's scary holding on and protecting your Bitcoin, because
yep.
the technology to make that easy is difficult to do, and because you are in control of your own value. So it's a challenge. There's a lot of challenges, and smart people are working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get there.
Yeah, there's we'll put up during the video, I'm going to put up an image of this kind of a pyramid that I drew up a little while ago, and I wrote my seminal piece, which was the Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash, about almost a year ago now. And it was something Adam Back, actually, you gonna bring him up? You got him?
Hey, buddy.
Oopa. Guys, this is Alfie, but we haven't actually decided to name him yet, so we could call him Frank. I don't know yet. Might call him Tony. it was this pyramid. So, you know, Murad Mahmudov. He's a Bitcoin guy, but he's a cool guy. So he did a piece afterwards, and Adam Back shared this around as well. But I talked about how store of value doesn't come from the beginning. It's, you know, we start with building a network that is secure, robust, and all that sort of stuff, and then we can start to build a bit of trust, and then you get store of value, then you can get all of the other sort of bits and pieces built on top of that. But we'll put that up on the screen so everyone can view it. There's a piece that I also wanted to touch on, which is one of the frustrations I always have with a lot of the Bcashers who are now the Babs and the BSVs.
Well, it depends which ones are you talking about.
Yeah, now. I don't know which ones anymore.
Let's stick with Bcash for now.
All right. They always talk about on the Bitcoin white paper, it says electronic peer-to-peer cash. But I don't think people understand what the definition of cash is. Cash is something, is a form of value transfer that maintains purchasing power. So whilst this asset is like this,
mm-hmm.
how the hell does it, how can it be defined as cash? It can't be defined as cash, because that's not how it functions. Just because I can transfer you Bcash in a second and it's got the word cash in the name doesn't make it a better cash than what Bitcoin is. That doesn't mean shit. And that's one of the biggest problems with the entire Bitcoin Cash debate. And I don't even know why we're talking about this shit, but I think you mentioned it before about, you know, how Bitcoin's not a good currency at the moment, which it's not. Cash and currency is predicated on purchasing power. And whilst something is volatile, it functions more like an asset than a currency.
Yeah,
and I think that's a very important absolutely. Distinction for people to
right. Like the US dollar is a great, I mean, it's not a great store of value, but it's better than most of the other fiat currencies out there,
yep.
right?
Yep.
It's pretty damn stable.
Yep.
I've been traveling the world for a couple of years now, and it's great for me. I mean, I'm here in Australia now, everything is mm-hmm. at a 30% discount.
Yep.
Had I come here 2 years ago, I would have been at parity.
Yep. Yep.
And yeah, the US dollar is a better medium of exchange than the Australian dollar.
Yep.
Globally.
Yes.
Because it's a lot less volatile.
And
Bitcoin
more...
will get there.
Yeah.
And one of these days, Bitcoin should be better than the US dollar. The interesting things that are gonna happen is I'm more worried, like I don't want some kind of a catastrophe happening now because I don't think the Bitcoin infrastructure is that robust yet to handle a billion people.
Yep.
Probably need at 100%. Least 2 to 3 years.
Yep.
So the last thing I want right now is the fall of the US dollar. The last thing I want right now is the collapse of the, you know, the European currency into its components, because these kinds of shocks to the leading currencies of the world will drive so many people into Bitcoin. And the other thing that people don't realize, a lot of people focus on the unbanked, and a lot of people focus on these developing countries in major trouble, like mm-hmm. the Venezuelas, like Iran, like even the Argentinian currency. That I don't see that driving the next wave of innovation and adoption. I see it more coming from the first world. It's the people in the first world, people in America, people in Europe, people in Australia, people in Canada, people with more resources, people with more money in the bank, the entrepreneurs that have always wanted to quit their jobs and have been saving a bunch of money in the bank. Those are the people who you don't want to lose the money. I don't care, I'm sorry, I don't care about the guy who's putting his last $20 into Bitcoin. I care more about the guy that has saved 100,000 euros to do something innovative with that money, and for him to protect it by putting that into Bitcoin, turning that into a few million that would allow him the resources to build an amazing company to help a billion poor people.
Yep, I can agree with that in terms of a timing thing. I think because it's still more of a asset than a currency that anybody can use, its utility is far greater in the first world than it is in the second world. Although it's got utility there for very different
right.
reasons. The pitch is very different.
Right, because the utility that Bitcoin provides to people in and again, we can go back to the
Sapiens.
To the Sapiens book, right? The utility that Bitcoin currently provides to the developing world in trouble is on the individual level.
Yes.
The utility that Bitcoin provides in the developed world with the entrepreneurs, that can scale.
Yep.
That kind of utility scales because you can build things by having Bitcoin to help an entire country that's developing. But in a developed world, it's all individual. There's not that kind of cooperation.
Yep. Well, it's still grassroots over there. And so it's a different phase and a different stage. I had on here global markets, macro view and all that sort of stuff. You just touched on, you know, the US dollar and everything. Now, back in the day, we talked about this in the car, we've sort of come into Bitcoin from a similar sort of angle. You heard about it from Max Keiser first. I can't remember whether it was Max or whoever, but I was sort of a gold bug back in the day, and I think we've all had that disease at some stage, right? And thought that gold was going to be worth, what was it supposed to be worth by now? 2020 was supposed to be like 50 grand or something.
I have an amazing, I have it in one of my charts. So I found this article from People Magazine.
Yep.
Published in, I think, 1981 or 1981, 1982. So gold had just fallen from the 875 peak,
yep.
and it was trading down at $500
yep.
from 875. And Doug Casey was being interviewed there.
Doug Casey.
And that was an amazing piece. So he's talking about how gold is gonna be worth $3,000 by in the next 2 or 3 years, and this is in 1981. he's talking about how you need to protect yourself and you need to buy things like that you can then barter with, like knives.
Yeah.
That was one of his suggestions.
Okay.
Like it was really amazing. And then he also, and in that piece, he's like, you know, and there are also other parts of the world where you can do really well. For example, maybe you want to consider buying real estate in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Like it was like you couldn't make it up. Like you read this article from 1981 and literally the opposite happened on even like the micro scale.
Yeah. Doug Casey's still around. I saw an interview with him months ago, and he was actually starting to talk about crypto, and I was like, okay.
But like I'll send it to you.
Please, read
it. And then like he gives all of it there about, and it's the same exact speech he does today.
Yep.
And I'm like, wow, you know, so you've been wrong for 30 years.
And they don't change their
right.
Peter Schiff is another one, but anyway, go on, sorry.
Right, and but besides that, so it doesn't have 30 years, and like, well, now what, right? Yeah. And yeah, so I just found it, I just found reading that really comical, and the funniest thing was, after he talks about all this and how you're supposed to be independent and how you can't, you know, depend on government, how you can't work for anyone, you know, you gotta do it all yourself, and then afterward the author goes, however, money has never really been a problem for Doug Casey. He comes from like a very rich family, and like his father was like, had like direct connections to like the government, and like like it's like, oh, this is interesting.
Yeah. Look. Yeah, I think Taleb would have something interesting to say.
Oh, wrong for 37 years. It's been a while, man. Time flies.
I know, right?
Almost 40.
Well, this is another, like, he's a great example. You know, Peter Schiff's another great example of people who are just too hard-headed, or they don't want to take time to understand things further. And like, they're still to this day talking about the collapse of the US dollar because they don't get why currencies collapse.
They'll eventually be right.
Exactly.
But I don't think they'll be alive.
Exactly. Anyone can eventually be right if they say the same thing for 100 years, right? Yeah, it's like perma bears or perma bulls, right?
Right.
And particularly perma bears, like you know,
markets do eventually crash.
They do, exactly. But then these guys just say crash, and then the day that it finally crashes, then they're all of a sudden geniuses, right? So you know, touching on that is, you know, a lot of people look at the markets these days and say, oh yeah, you know, the U.S. dollar is going to collapse, and all the markets are going to collapse, and everything is going to collapse, and we're going to fall into Armageddon, and it's all over. You know, my thoughts on that, like me personally, I'm buying US dollars, and I've been buying US dollars for the last 4 or 5 months because I know that in general downturns or at peaks of credit cycles, you want to hold cash over traditional assets. But what's your thoughts on the state of the market in general?
You know, I think the stock market, especially the US markets, are at a very, very critical point right now.
Yeah.
I really need to see how it opens on Monday because the U.S. just had a major holiday. It's actually, as far as the stock market's concerned, this is actually the biggest holiday for the stock market because there's no, at no point is the stock market closed for more than one day. So all the holidays that involve the stock market, you only get one day and then it starts trading again. Now during Thanksgiving, it's closed a day and a half.
Oh, really?
So the rule of thumb is this is not the week to judge.
Yep.
We have to see how the stock market opens on Monday and Tuesday. This is like the last hope, I think. I believe that I'm still optimistic that the stock market is going to reverse this week coming up. And the worst is already over. It's possible the market could correct. But even if the market corrects, I don't see a big global crash right now. I just don't see it yet. I think that I'm getting ready for another wave of innovation. Like, I'm still waiting for that self-driving car. That's going to create amazing efficiency. I think the tech companies still have a lot they can do. I just don't see it. I don't see any major wars on the horizon between countries. I mean, some talk between Russia and China, sorry, between Russia and America, you know, China and
Russia,
America.
China, America.
But they're not going to do anything.
Yep.
I'm just not too worried at the moment. I mean, again, as a studying geology as my first degree that I got, I'm more worried about a potential, you know, geological disaster. We haven't had one in my lifetime that I'm aware of. And I mean, if we're overdue for anything, it's a geological disaster. That honestly worries me a little bit more. This economic stuff,
I didn't expect you to say that.
It's on a small scale.
Okay, I didn't expect you to say that. The geological part. So Tone's a DJ and a geologist in his part time, by the way. Okay, look, I agree on the timing in terms of I don't think anything imminent is impending. Yeah. But again, we don't know how to measure the madness of crowds, and you know, Bitcoin's a good example of that in terms on the way up and on the way down. You know, no one was expecting any of this sort of stuff, and you know, me personally, I take a more macro approach or macro view in the sense that The data is showing that the world is moving into what's called Quad 4. And this is sort of Ray Dalio's model of, you've got Quad 1, and I can't remember the quads exactly, but I do remember Quad 4 is slowing inflation and slowing growth. So there's two things happening at once. And generally, the Fed, they're going to always, you know, late to the table because all of the data that comes in is generally 3 to 6 months old, and they're always catching up with things. So I think what we're moving into is an environment of kind of like we're coming down from a high. Now, does that mean that the markets are going to collapse tomorrow? Probably not. But I like living in Australia is all we're seeing a massive unwind here. We have not seen the real estate market fall more than 3 to 5% for the last probably 20 years. And it has fallen just in Brisbane. We're talking 15% in the last 12 months. So there's things that are starting to happen. And I mean, again, I'm hopeful that it doesn't on the basis that it's probably going to have a negative impact on crypto initially, because if we look at crypto, it's just like a derivative. People are just going to run away from anything that's risky, and they're going to go to whatever safe haven they can find. And the ultimate safe haven at the moment in the world, I don't give a shit what anybody says, is the US dollar.
Yeah, it is. I agree with that. And there's another thing, and I noticed that this is what got me out of being a gold bug. When the 08 crisis happened, started with real estate in the US, moved on to the whole banking sector. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when the banking sector was on the verge of collapsing, every business in America was on the verge of collapsing, because if the banks go down, how is your business going to function?
Exactly.
Not to mention, if all those banks go down, that's a lot of people that used to be employed with high paying jobs that are no longer employed in high paying jobs. That affects every business.
Yep.
Because now they don't go and spend any money because they don't earn any money.
Yep.
And when that happens, the whole country suffers. Yep. Everybody suffers. Everyone becomes poorer.
Yep.
And the last thing you even have time for is going out, learning and reading about a speculative asset like Bitcoin.
Correct, right? Exactly.
I mean, you have more important things to do, like how are you gonna feed your family next week, right? You're too busy.
Mm-hmm.
So Bitcoin should do very well when everyone's fat and happy. And when people are nervous and they're panicky, like their wife ain't gonna let them invest their last $1,000
exactly
in Bitcoin,
right? Correct.
Like it just doesn't work that way.
So true.
But when you just got a nice fat rich bonus and you're like, hey, I'm gonna throw 10,000 into Bitcoin and here's 20 for you to go shopping, like, yep, no one has a problem, you know?
100%. Look, in the spirit of not having much time, I think, you know, I really wanted to dig a little bit further into all of this stuff, but you know, I agree on that. Generally, for people out there that are listening to this, I would, you know, if you're trying to do anything with markets now, you know, I'd be more in cash. I'd be more in things that, you know, something that is an actual stable store of value. And, you know, whilst inflation exists and all that sort of stuff, your US dollar is not going to disappear tomorrow. And out of all the currencies, it's probably the best one to hold. I mean, Swiss franc is probably another one as well. But as things start to unwind, all assets start to get correlated and they fall, especially the more speculative ones, they just fall a lot faster. And then things like, you know, I still think, you know, if gold where we are at 1200, it's probably gonna go and retest, like you've said, 875. It's got a long way to go. And it's just got this beautiful drop flag and it's prepping for another walk off another cliff. And if it does, it seems like that's going to coincide with some sort of market issues. But after that, there is potential for it to have upside again and to start another wave. But only then do you want to think about other assets. You generally want to start with, you know, real estate, gold, hard assets, and then move into other things afterwards. But anyway, it's enough of my philosophizing. Tone, wanted to say thank you for coming to Brisbane. Come and hanging out with us.
Thanks, man.
The meetup was great. We're going to post a video up about the meetup, or probably by the time you watch this, the video is already going to be up. We're going to do another shout out from the poker game. I think we're going to.
Yeah, we'll do something from the poker game.
Yep. We did the workshop, so you know everyone who came to the workshop got a lot out of it. you're planning to come back to Australia, what, exactly 12 months roughly, or?
Yeah, right now the plan, until you buy the plane ticket,
anything can happen. You don't know exactly, yeah, till the last minute.
As of right now, I'm planning to spend the last 2 weeks of November next year, back here in Australia.
Yep.
I'm usually around Thailand in October, and I stop here in Australia before I move on to Latin America. I'm already, my global travel for next year is already filling up all the way into December. It's really crazy how that is.
We need to find Tone a companion to travel with him. So someone to help him with all the bookings and all that sort of stuff, and maybe some other stuff. I'm going to, again, just a reminder, these books. So you got Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, and you've got Skin in the Game by Nassim Taleb. That one will tell you why the ICO thing was really, really fucking stupid. it's a really, really good, again, and it's got nothing to do with crypto ICOs or all that sort of stuff, but these are great books which talk about principles that I think people need to understand.
Hey, before we sign off, let's talk about Bitcoin a little bit in Australia.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
So, I mean, you've been here, you've been in Brisbane now for a few years, you were in Sydney before that.
Yep.
What are you seeing from how the government is accepting, dealing with it? I heard there's like so many businesses that are accepting Bitcoin, even though the majority of them converted to fiat immediately.
Yep.
But
yep.
there is a push for these businesses to hold on to the Bitcoin. Maybe as the next bull market starts, it'll be easier to convince them that it's already bottomed.
Yep.
So how are you seeing Bitcoin here in Australia?
Okay, so there's two things. Well, there's a couple things. So in Australia, there's a big push to talk about blockchain, right? Because all the
everywhere.
I know, right? Because all the corporates think they missed out and they just want to create their own little buzzword. So there's a big push for that from a government and from an institutional standpoint, which is obviously, as we know, waste of time and just, it's classic late to the party type discussion, right? Mm-hmm. There's, From a project standpoint, we have some good exchanges here that have been around for a long time. Like the guys at Independent Reserve, you know, I take my hat off to them. They set up their exchange in 2013. And you wouldn't expect that from Australia. It's like, what, 2013? I remember when talking to Lysenko, who was one of the founders there. Cool guy. And you know, they're doing some really good stuff in terms of how to custody the assets. Because, you know, whilst I agree with you on this idea of an unconfiscatable asset and you holding your private key and self-custody and all of that, it's really important for people who know how to do that. For the mass population though, they should not self-custody because they're hopeless. Like, and that's not their skill set. I mean, most people's idea of a secure password is 1234.
I agree, but we still need a solution to make those assets unconfiscatable by the government and by the third party that is providing that asset. That service.
That solution, I don't even know what it looks like.
It's a multi-sig solution that I believe is possible, but will be tricky.
Potentially, whilst I think you can develop a multi-sig solution in the background, I think the solution on the front end is where the big challenge is going to be, is how to convince people to use something that is foreign. Because one of the most important functions that banks represent is this idea of safe custody of assets. Mm-hmm. And you know, the ability, like if you lose your internet banking password, you can walk in there and get it.
Correct.
Again, you haven't lost all your money.
Correct.
If you lose your private key, you're fucking screwed. So anyway, I think that's not going to be, I don't believe that's going to be a silver bullet problem that's solved. I think that's going to be a multi-lead bullet problem. It's something that we're just going to have to chip away, and we'll get better and we'll get it to the point where it actually functions. And I think honestly, exchanges and wallets, those two bits of infrastructure are going to be probably where the breakthrough comes, is they're going to have to work out, due to survival, they're going to have to work out ways to make that function better. Now, you know, coming back to Australia, then what's going on here? Very similar to the States in terms of, I think you guys have FinCEN over there. We've got AUSTRAC, which does all the KYC and AML. So all exchanges now are regulated by that. They seem to be pretty open. I've sat in a bunch of AUSTRAC meetings, talked about what this is. They're still trying to wrap their head around, they still think a large proportion of Bitcoin is used for illicit purposes when it's not. I think the last statistics were it's less than 1% versus, you know, just as an example, 12% of all US dollars are used for illicit purposes. So it's like there's a double standard there. So I think there's still a lot of education to come. I mean, at this stage, it's still being viewed as property, not as a currency. So, you know, you can trade it, you can do all this sort of stuff. So it's, you don't need any financial services licensing to be an exchange and to do all
that
sort of stuff.
That's actually a good thing.
It is, exactly. At this point in time, it's a very good thing.
Yeah.
Later on, when we want to function more like a currency, then it needs to evolve. But up until then, I think right now it needs to be viewed as purely an asset. So, I don't know, I think Australia is a good place for crypto, and we've got some interesting hubs. So like Brisbane is a real hub for it, and I think it happened as a fluke here. Sydney and Melbourne are a little bit fragmented. They're larger cities and there's people all over the place. Whereas Brisbane, it's still a decent sized city, 2 million, 2.5 million people, but it's small enough for all of the major activity to be happening within a couple kilometers of itself. Mm-hmm. So you end up with a really strong community, and that's why you've got, you know, all of these merchants accepting Bitcoin and doing all this, because there's a bit of a push, there's noise, there's people talking about it. You know, we're doing stuff with Amber here, trying to make it easier for people to accumulate and dollar cost average and hold some. So I think the Australian environment is quite vibrant, but I mean, you know, we're bound by very similar laws to the US.
Yeah.
So that would be my comments on Australia.
Yeah, no, and yeah, like I've been saying on my podcast, I'm really enjoying Brisbane.
Yeah, everyone's gonna move to Brisbane.
Yeah, and to close out, I guess tell us a little bit about Amber and what you guys are actually doing.
Yeah, really quickly is we've taken the playbook from, if you look at Robinhood or Acorns or any of those guys, and what they did was they said, look, E-Trade and Ameritrade and CompSec here in Australia, they built software to help the sophisticated investor and trader get access to equities and products and all that sort of stuff, right? And they did that 20 years ago and they were very successful. 4 or 5 years ago, Robinhood and Acorns came out and they created applications that allowed the retail market, the general populace, to get involved in the same asset classes in a way that was simple, easy, and effective. And when I was sitting there looking at crypto last year, or Bitcoin, crypto, the whole lot, and I was saying, Jesus, you know, I would walk down the street, and I actually did this experiment with 1,000 people. I'd walk down the street and I'd say, hey, have you heard of Bitcoin or crypto? Yes. Do you have any? No. Do you know where to buy it from? No. Do you know what to do with it? No. Do you know how much to buy? No idea. Would you throw a couple dollars at it each day or your spare change, something you didn't notice? Yeah, I'd do that. And that was literally the conversation that I had with a lot of people, and I thought, okay, there's got to be a market here. Now, the technological complexity of moving small amounts of money and converting that to Bitcoin and then allocating it to people's wallets, that's the hard part, and that's why no one had built something like that, particularly in Australia, because we've got our banking data's closed and all this sort of other stuff, which makes this kind of a business really difficult to do. There is a company that realized how difficult it was to do that went out and they did an ICO. They raised, they did a token sale. It was a complete disaster, and they created basically what was like a Binance token for the sake of helping adoption. So now they've got a token in the way of buying it. It's a disaster.
Yeah. I've been saying that forever.
It made me angry, man. So I got pitched by so many people to do an ICO and we didn't. And I say this at all my talks, I said, before I made that final decision, I ended up reading 20 white papers over a weekend and my IQ dropped by 20 points. I just thought this was the dumbest shit I've ever read and people are raising money on this stuff. I thought, okay, I am not fucking doing this because this is a house of cards. So when we built it, we just built it simple. You download it, you link it to your bank account and you get on with your life. And people, we live in a spending society today. We spend on everything, Uber, this, that, all sorts of stuff. So we're taking that habit of spending and converting it into something that every time you spend, we round it up to the nearest dollar and we take that spare change and we allocate it to Bitcoin straight away. Bang, bang, bang. And you won't even realize it. And after a year of doing it, you'll have saved up $500 or $1,000 worth of Bitcoin.
Right. And this is a perfect time to start doing that.
Exactly.
Actually,
yeah.
Because we're not that far from the lows. People will be surprised how much they could end up with a year later.
Absolutely. If people start doing it now, and for the next 1 or 2 years, 3 years, just accumulate. And I would, again, this is not financial advice, but we will have a feature on Amber where you can do $10, $20, $30 a week. You can automate that as well as your spare change. You can do all these sorts of stuff to sort of accelerate.
I would give them the option, round to the nearest $5,
that's it,
round to the nearest $10.
It'll all be in there, exactly. And then that way people
give them an option to like spend a little more.
And people can save it up. And you would not believe how powerful that is over the long term, because that's the one thing people don't do. Like, and you're in trading, you know, people people get things the wrong way around when it comes to trading. They buy high, sell low, because emotion fucks it all up. This takes the emotion out of it. So anyway, it's enough about Amber, enough about me. Tone, thank you for coming.
Hey, thanks, man. Thanks really for the invite. It. We're
going to play a little bit of poker. Done. I got a practice for the Unconfiscatable Celebrity Poker Game. And that's going to happen
if you win, if you win, you're going to split the winnings with me, all right? Because I gave you some practice.
If I beat Doug Polk at his game along with my game.
Yeah. Yes.
No, I don't think I'm going to win, but it'll be a lot of fun. I can't wait. I can't wait to play.
Cool, man. All right, bro. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for watching.